This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. And I have with me today Dr. Shane Wallace, the Walsh Family Lecturer in Classics in Ancient History at Trinity College, Dublin. So first off, thank you so much, Shane, for speaking with me today.
Well, it's my pleasure, absolutely.
Now, you are studying the relationship between kings and cities, and particularly during the Hellenistic period. So this is a very specific niche thing to be studying, which I think is very interesting as a relationship. And obviously the most famous person from the Hellenistic period would be the one who ushered it in, Alexander the Great. So maybe you could start off by explaining to us a little bit what the relationship between kings and cities are and how that looks with Alexander the Great.
Thanks. Yes. So where to begin with this? Yes, I suppose it could be construed as something of a niche, but at the same time, the Hellenistic period is very, very big. It's a big, big historical period. You know, classical Greece is Persian Wars to the death of Alexander, so about 480 to 323. But the Hellenistic period is the death of Alexander until the death of Cleopatra. So we're looking at about 300 years, from 323 all the way to 31, 30 BC. And in terms of geography, again, it's a huge period as well. So it's the breadth of Alexander's empires, I suppose, from his conquests from ancient Macedon all the way to Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, even parts of the small bits into northwestern modern-day India, but including all of Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as Egypt, too. So it's a huge, huge geographical world and a very, very large chronological spread of time. So anyone who studies this period really has to try and narrow it down a little bit. So what I work on is, indeed, as you said, the relationship between kings and cities in the Hellenistic period, but specifically between the old Greek city-states of mainland Greece, the Aegean Islands, and Western Asia Minor, and their relationship with the new Macedonian monarchies, new powers that took over in that area in the late 4th and 3rd centuries BC. So really, what I'm looking at here, what I work on and what I study, is the interaction and the tension between old established Greek polis and city-states like Athens and Sparta, but also less well-known ones perhaps like Ephesus or Kos or Chios or Miletus, and their traditions of freedom, democracy, autonomy, self-government, independence, with the new Macedonian monarchy that arrives under Philip and Alexander, and thereafter with their successors. And it's that negotiation of power, that negotiation of balance between the traditions of the polis, the self-governing city-state, the Greek polis, and the new Macedonian monarchy, which is very much authoritarian, autocratic, and concerned with the monopolization of royal power. So it's that balance between royal authority and civic independence.
So I imagine that the ancient Athenians and Spartans would not be big fans of having a monarch, considering that they had this sort of democratic tradition.
Absolutely not, no. Sparta was a monarchy, famously. It was a diarchy. It had two kings. But this is a very unusual tradition in the Greek world. In the archaic period, roughly 8th, 7th, 6th centuries BC, in the archaic period, Greece had kind of gone past monarchy. They'd moved on to tyranny, and they'd moved on to democracy and oligarchy and various forms of self-government, representative self-government, particularly through democracy and oligarchy. Sparta was strange in that it had this dual monarchy, this diarchy. But what you see in the late classical period is kind of an inversion of the norm. Athens and Sparta, Thebes, were always the big, powerful city-state. They had empires. Athens had the Athenian Empire in the Aegean world in the 5th century. Sparta had a huge alliance of powerful city-states allied in the Peloponnese, the Peloponnesian League, both of which clashed with the Peloponnesian War in the late 5th century. But with the rise of Macedon under Philip in the 4th century, what you saw was, across a generation or two, maybe three generations, a flip. So whereas the big power in the Aegean world throughout the archaic and classical periods had really been the Greek polis, well, excluding for a short period Persian hegemony before the Persian Wars, it had really been the Greek polis, the Greek city-state, Athens and Sparta and Thebes, the big powers. Macedon was on the border, it's up at the very, very north, a kind of buffer state between the Greek city-states and kind of Celtic tribes and Thracian, Illyrians, Epirotes, all these other semi-Greek or non-Greek peoples. But with the rise of Philip, what happened was Macedon became the big power. And by the end of Philip's reign, this was the case. Macedon was the single biggest power in the Balkans and in the Aegean world. And there was a strong reaction against that in the big city-states like Sparta, Athens, and Thebes, which really did not like and were pretty much vehemently opposed to the rise of Macedonian power because they had the most to lose from it. Athens lost its empire. Sparta lost land in the Peloponnese. Thebes was destroyed, wiped out by Alexander the Great. It was a ruin for 20 years. So they lost a huge amount with the rise of Macedonian power. Although the balance of that is, who benefited from it? And where did Macedon have its allies? With the smaller Greek city-states. City-states like Plataea or Megalopolis or Homonos or Thespiae or Mantinea or Messene in the Peloponnese. Small Greek city-states that had still powerful, still large, but had for a very, very long period of time been under the control of Thebes or Athens or Sparta. And when those were brought low by Philip and Alexander, it was a balance of power was made by the rising up and the strengthening of these smaller Greek city-states. So they gained a massive amount. Plataea and Mantinea or Komnenos, Megalopolis, they gained a huge amount from the rise of Macedon. Because Macedon offered a way out of the continuous cycle of empire between Athens and Sparta, between democracy and oligarchy. And as a consequence, you find a great popularity for Macedon in many of these small city-states, Plataea and Megalopolis particularly. They fought with Macedon against Sparta and against Athens. They had statues of the kings. They passed honors for them. In Megalopolis, there was a stoa of Philip. There were statues of Philip and Athens in the marketplace. So it's a story of the kind of reversal of the old norm. The city-states of Athens, Thebes, and their empires brought low, and the monarchy of Macedon raised up, but also tension and opposition between Macedon and Athens, Sparta, Thebes, but also very close engagement and developing new relationships between Macedon and many of the smaller city-states as well.
So I'm curious to the role and direct influence that Alexander and also Philip II would have had with these city-states when, you know, they're off in, well, I mean, talk about Alexander specifically, when he's off in Pakistan and Afghanistan. I mean, he's so far away. How much impact is he really having on Athens?
That's a good question. When you could kind of divide Alexander's reign from the perspective of the Greek city-states, you could perhaps divide Alexander's reign into three. There's the period when he's in Greece. He comes to the throne in 336, and he's in Greece from 336 until 334, and then he begins his campaigns in the east, but he's still in close contact with Athens and other Greek city-states through embassies and things, and letters even, back and forth until about, oh, I don't know, 331, thereabouts. After he leaves Egypt in 331, fights the Battle of Gaugamela in October, I think, 331. The second kind of phase of his reign then might take you from about 330 until about 324, when he's campaigning in the furthest east, when he's campaigning in Afghanistan, Bactria, ancient Bactria, modern Afghanistan, the areas that the Greeks called the upper satrapies, the furthest stretch of the Persian Empire, the furthest part of the world away from them. And in the third period of his reign, from the Greek perspective, you might consider to be the last year of his life, when he returns to Babylon in 324, and he begins to prepare these campaigns, these future plans, these last plans, they're called by Diodorus, that remain unfulfilled. A conquest of the Arabian Peninsula, building a road across North Africa, and defeating the Carthaginian Empire, conquering the Western Mediterranean, perhaps a war against Athens too. So while he's first part of his reign, while he's in the Greek world and while he's in Asia Minor, he's in close connection with Athens and Athens, the Greek city-states. And at the end of his reign, he's in quite close connection with them too. We have a lot of evidence of ambassadors and letters and things. But for that middle third, when he's in the furthest east, very hard. We don't really know very much about it. Or at least we don't have a lot of evidence of his contact with the Greek world at this time. One orator, Athenian orator, Aeschines, in his speech against Ctesiphon, when was this? Summer, autumn 331. He describes Alexander, who at this time, around this point in, summer 330, I think it was. So at this point in time, Alexander will be kind of in Afghanistan area. Aeschines describes Alexander as having gone beyond the borders of the known world, the Oikoumene. So rhetorically, there's this dramatic emphasis on Alexander having stretched beyond the borders of the known world. But he wasn't quite gone that far. But we don't really know. We don't have a lot of evidence of connections at that point in time. Mainly it was done through Alexander's generals who were left in command of Greece. Antipater was in charge of Macedon and Greece while Alexander was in the east, and it was mainly through him that Greek city-states had their contact with Macedonian power, not directly with the king, but through his intermediaries.
So it should be the relationship between the king, the cities and the generals.
At that point in time, definitely. It wasn't a direct relationship that Athens or any other Greek city-state really had with Alexander while he was in the furthest east. Their relationship would have been with the representatives of royal power, his commanders, his generals, his satraps, who were in charge of the satrapies, the regional districts of the empire. So this is what intermediaries are for, I suppose. Not everyone has direct contact with the king at all points in time. They go through intermediaries.
Yeah.
And for the Greeks, the most visible sign of Macedonian power was the governor of Macedon and Greece, Antipater.
Yeah. So was the relationship different between Alexander the Great and Philip II, or did Alexander sort of just continue the same relationship?
That's a good question. It's kind of hard they seem to be very, very different, Philip and Alexander. A part of that reason might be because ancient authors describe them as being quite different, talk about them as being different. It also might be that Philip died on the cusp of something that Alexander then undertook. So when Philip, indeed some authors actually, I think Justin describes it, Alexander is the one who's known as the Great, but Philip is, there is a line of thought in antiquity that Philip was the one who perhaps deserved the epithet more. Because Philip was the one who inherited Macedon in 359, I think it was, he came to the throne. And Macedon was on the point of implosion, in fact, attacked from all sides. And he turned it into the single biggest power in the Aegean world. So at the time of his death, the Macedonian army was the largest and strongest professional army in the ancient world. Macedon wasn't a particularly rich kingdom, but it had decent reserves, I suppose. It had good mind that could be drawn on. Macedonian control of Greece had been formalized and institutionalized by Philip through this thing called the League of Corinth, which was an alliance of Greek city-states under Macedonian control. The last thing Philip or Alexander wanted was to unify Greece, but it was an alliance of Greek city-states under Macedonian control, and there was money coming from that. They contributed troops to the Macedonian army to fight in the east. And Philip had taken the initial steps towards this campaign, this invasion of the Persian Empire in Asia Minor. So in the moment at which he died, everything was kind of set up for Alexander. He had the army, he had the men, he had the generals and that brilliant military generation of Philip's and his own. He had the alliance basis in Greece, the League of Corinth that he could draw on as a sort of a formalized diplomatic alliance of Greek states under Macedonian control and troops from that. The invasion of Asia Minor had begun briefly, and there was a beachhead established in Asia Minor under Macedonian troops. So when Alexander came to the throne, it's quite clear he was itching to go. He was ready to go, and he had to mop up some resistance in Greece. But he was really building on this very, very solid foundation that Philip had established. And as a result, he's a completely different king, because Alexander is king of Macedon from 336 until 323. but he only spends two of those 13 or 14 years in Europe. The rest of it, he's abroad. So he's a king that the Macedonians don't really ever get to see, which is a big, big opposition to Philip, who was a king who was omnipresent in Macedon and spent all of his time campaigning in Thrace, next to Macedon, in Macedon itself, and further south into Greece. So it's a larger question, a bigger issue, but they seem to have been very, very different. But Alexander was inheriting something that had been set up and established by Philip, and that's the basis that allowed him to become Alexander the Great, that allowed him to have that conquest of the Persian Empire.
Yeah, I do always feel bad for Philip II. You know, he just doesn't get nearly the attention or the credit or the glamour that Alexander the Great gets.
No, he doesn't, does he?
No, but you know,
no, he doesn't get the glamour or the attention, no. We know a lot less about his reign than we do about Alexander's, actually.
Yeah, but Alexander the Great, I mean, look, he was pretty good looking, you know, for all intents and purposes, and, you know, died young in a dramatic way. Like, that's all the stuff for fame today, even, you know. Got to leave a good-looking corpse and people will remember you.
He was a mummified corpse, yeah. He was buried in honey, I think, in Babylon to keep him preserved. And then he was a bit like Lenin. He was he was mummified and then placed the body was kidnapped by Ptolemy and placed in a glass sarcophagus, I think, in Memphis and then later in Alexandria. So it became a tourist attraction until, I think, the 3rd century A.D.,
Wow. I went to...
Yeah, he left a famous, beautiful, highly visible corpse.
Yeah, I remember seeing Lenin and after following a line of maybe for about an hour of Chinese tourists to be in, and he looked so purplish, the skin. It was creepy. I hope that Alexander's mummification looked a bit better.
Yeah, I don't know. There was a story that... was it Augustus knocked the nose off or broke the nose? It was either Augustus or Caracalla, I can't remember. But one of the two emperors went to inspect the corpse and knocked the nose off. So I don't know what condition he was in, but...
So continuing with the idea of mummies, but in a completely different realm, Alexander's successors, obviously there's quite a few, but I might argue one of the most famous would be the Ptolemaic dynasty who ruled over Egypt. So the relationship between king and city, I mean, it must have been completely changed in Egypt, even though you still had these Greeks ruling, because the Egyptian culture is so distinct from the Greek culture, and then in the country, the language, everything. Like, how did that affect that dynamic?
Yeah, completely. You're completely right. So this is another one of these features of Alexander's empire, which is it takes over the Persian Empire. But it encompasses and includes lots of much, much, much older kingdoms and empires. So Egypt is one good example of this, but also Babylon, for instance, and the various Babylonian empires, also even further east, perhaps, but also in the area of, where would it be? I'm trying to remember what it was called at the time. Palestine, Judea, that kind of region as well. You're dealing with much older civilizations that have been, you know, very long established, culturally distinct and different kingdoms and empires. So I work on the old Greek world, mainland Greece, the Aegean, and Western Asia Minor, and it's that continuity of polis tradition that I see there. But when you go to Egypt, it is, as you point out, is a bit different, because the polis, the city-state, is as we understand it and study it, a Greek phenomenon. Now, it's not that cities didn't exist in Egypt. They did, but it was a different phenomenon. It wasn't the polis city-state with this idea of self-government and independence, freedom, autonomy, democracy, etc., etc. Cities in Egypt were by and large based around temple sites. Based around temple sites, I would say. Thebes, Memphis, Heliopolis, places like this, perhaps Saqqara as well. They're religious sites first and foremost. They are huge, large temple sites. There were Greek foundations in Egypt, one from the 7th century BC, now Crates, which was a trading colony, but also Alexandria, which is perhaps the most famous of these. And these were polis, these were city-states. But they were also different in some ways as well. Now, Crates was more than anything else, it was a trading post. Alexandria was the capital, the Ptolemaic capital, capital of the Ptolemaic Empire, which was indeed the most famous of Alexander's successor states because it was the one that lasted the longest. And it ended with Cleopatra, probably the second most famous Hellenistic person after Alexander the Great. But these were not necessarily self-governing city-states in the same way that you had in the old Greek world. A demos, adult male citizens who could meet and vote and pass motions, decrees of the city. Didn't really have a demos with an ecclesia or a vouli in the way that you had in other Greek city-states. Alexandria was a royal capital, and as a result was very closely under royal control. There must have been some form of city council, I think, but the city was almost a third of the city, a quarter to a third of the city was taken up by the palace of the Ptolemies. So it was very, very much a closely controlled imperial capital. So very different to what you would have had in the city-states of the old Greek world. And this is a phenomenon we see in other other Hellenistic empires too. So the Seleucid Empire refounded Babylon, they found the Seleucia on the Tigris. Again, city-states, but very different in character to what you have in the old Greek world. Pergamon, which was a foundation and capital, which was an earlier foundation but became capital of the Attalid kingdom in Western Asia Minor. Demetrias, which became the capital of the Antigonid kingdom in mainland Greece. So you find a lot of these new foundations, new cities, and Alexandria being the most famous in Egypt, but they are similar to, but also in many ways quite different from the city-state that you would have found in the old Greek world.
And so in the Greek world, going back to back home, so to speak, would Alex and Alexander and Philip's relationship to the city-states be very different, surely, in Macedon versus further afield? Like when it was in their own lands, were they just worshipped and regarded, and then abroad, further away, kind of hated? I mean, was he seen as an invader or a liberator?
Good point. I suppose the kind of a Freudian answer, but by far the most sensible answer, I think, would be it depends on which region you were looking at. So in Macedon, they were the Macedonian kings, and they were part of the Argead dynasty, the Temenid dynasty, and they were legitimate Macedonian kings, and they were given the relative honors that Macedonian kings were given and had the status in society that Macedonian kings had. One thing that is slightly different with them is that you start to see some evidence, under Philip certainly, of perhaps cult honors for the living king, which seems to be not necessarily terribly unusual in the Greek world. There were precedents, but in Macedon, the earliest examples we have are of Philip, definitely, for receiving cult honors. But in mainland Greece, Philip and Alexander, as I mentioned earlier, they weren't very well looked upon by states that lost power under them. So Athens, Sparta, Thebes, which actually lost its existence under Alexander. But they were very, very favorably viewed by smaller Greek city-states that gained a lot from being liberated from Athens, Sparta, and Thebes. If you go to Asia Minor then, just to kind of follow Alexander's route, so to speak, if you go to Asia Minor, Alexander has an incredibly positive afterlife. He's remembered for centuries, 500, 600, maybe even 700 years. He is remembered as the founder of the bringer of freedom and democracy to Asia Minor. Because Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, the Greek city-state there, had been under the control of the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire liked to control city-states with tyrants. So they would install or promote or support local tyrants. Because it's easier to negotiate with one person than it is to negotiate with a democracy. Mm. So when Alexander arrived, he threw out the Persian garrisons, threw out the Persian tyrants, and said, I'm giving you all your freedom. I'm restoring democracy to you. And there was a massive outpouring of popular support for him. And we have inscriptions from centuries afterwards, literary accounts too, 600 years afterwards, describing Alexander as a bringer of freedom and of democracy. In Egypt, too, he seems to have been positively received because Persia was very, very unpopular in Egypt. Egypt had been part of the Persian Empire since the late 6th century, but they had revolted three times from the empire in the 480s, the 450s, and the 350s or 340s, I think. so they had revolted a number of times. So when Alexander arrived, Egypt came to the Macedonian side without a fight. And he takes the role of Pharaoh, and he appears on numerous temple walls, dedications, as the Pharaoh of Egypt, Alexander. Indeed, we have from a small oasis, kind of halfway between Nubia and Memphis, we have an altar that's dedicated to Alexander, to Amun, which records his complete pharaonic titulature, which is quite remarkable. But then as you go further east, the reception is a little bit different, because Alexander arrived more as a conqueror than a liberator. So the Persians obviously didn't have a very good view of him. When he reached the site of Persepolis, capital of the Persian Empire, he gave the city to his troops to rape and loot and plunder. And he took the palace, stripped it of all things that were valuable, and burned it to the ground. So Persepolis is not necessarily a good example of Alexander's afterlife. He is kind of negatively viewed there. He spends most of the 320s, certainly 4 or 5 years, campaigning in the area of modern-day Afghanistan and Pakistan, which he finds terribly difficult to conquer and to pacify because of, well, it's for the same reasons historically that it's known as the Graveyard of Empires. And the only way he manages to bring it on side is through a marriage alliance with Roxanne, his first wife. So, again, he finds it difficult in that part of the world too. But with Alexander's reputation, which is much, or his reception over time, is a much larger question. It again depends on where you are thinking about or talking about. In Greece, mixed reception, sometimes seen as a great liberator, sometimes seen quite negatively. Very positive image for the Greek cities of Western Asia Minor. Seems to be a positive image in Egypt, but elsewhere, such as Persepolis or even in Afghanistan, we would imagine, although we don't really have a lot of evidence for his afterlife there, but we would tend to imagine a much more negative response over time, where he would be seen more as an invader rather than a liberator.
So what I'm wondering is, we have this sort of extreme views of him in the ancient world, but in the modern world, the sort of lasting legacy is—he's still Alexander the Great. Like, I mean, he's still one of the most famous people in the whole ancient world. He's sort of seen as almost proudly capable of doing such wonderful things in regards to conquering this great empire. So basically, should we be calling Alexander the Great the Great? I mean, surely he did do some pretty murderous things. You mentioned the burning of Persepolis. In the year 2019, shouldn't we have a bit more of a balanced view on him? Should he be Alexander the Kind of Great?
The Kind of Great. Alexander the not as great as sliced bread, but Kind of Great. He's called Alexander the Great because this is what the ancients called him. Although they didn't seem to call him that until quite late. Actually, it's rather strange. The earliest reference to Alexander as the Great is in a Roman play by Plautus in the 190s BC. So 130 years after his life, after his death. So that's a little bit strange. Others were called great in historical sources before him. But by the ancient standards, he was great. Because what is it that made you a great commander? It essentially was how many people you killed and how successful you were. Hence why the Romans, when a Roman general or commander had a triumph, there was a numerical element to it. You had to have killed 5,000 of your enemies. So Alexander had, by the Roman numbers, I suppose, many, 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 many triumphs. So by that ancient qualification, yeah, he was the great. He was incredibly successful. And he's bloodthirsty by our standards, of course. Very violent. And sometimes reading the ancient sources about Alexander's reign is it's kind of depressing. So Arrian, who wrote about Alexander in the 2nd century AD, when he describes Alexander's return from India down the Indus Valley, down to the sea, and then across the south of Pakistan, ancient Gedrosia, it's just a litany of death and executions and just violent assaults and attacks on cities. So much so that probably one of the most famous 20th century scholars in Alexander, a guy called Bosworth, and he wrote a book on this, which was called The Tragedy of Triumph, because it was just such a depressing account of death. But by the ancient standards, that's what it was. So he is the great for that reason. But in terms of his, you know, in terms of his afterlife, he's someone who gives the model for what happens in the Hellenistic period, and even into the Roman period too. He's the model for his successors, the Hellenistic kings. And that's quite powerful. He's also Alexander the Great, perhaps because of other things he achieved. So, sure, military success is part of it, but for the Greek city-states of Western Asia Minor, of course he was a conqueror, but he was the person who brought them their freedom and democracy, destroyed the Persian Empire, and liberated all the Greeks from the existential threat of Persia that had existed since the late 6th century BC, really. And that's a huge achievement as well. The man who destroyed and overthrew the Persian Empire. That's kind of colossal. Most of the literary sources that survive for Alexander the Great are much, much later. And they're written under the Roman period. So the earliest is Diodorus Siculus, writing in the 1st century BC. And the last of these kind of five great Alexander historians will be writing around the year 200 AD. But Plutarch and Arrian, who write about Alexander, 2nd century AD. So very much the Alexander we have today from the ancient sources, the ancient literary sources, is a Roman Alexander. It's an Alexander that was written about in the Roman period. And that's quite interesting too, because when the surviving sources are writing about Alexander, they're writing from a point of time when the world is Roman. The world is part of the Roman Empire on three continents, Europe, Africa, and Asia. So for the Greeks, in the 1st, 2nd centuries AD, Alexander becomes a model of how great Greece was and how great Macedon was. That for as powerful as Rome is now, there was a Greek who was even more powerful than that. And one of the epithets that's used, one of the adjectives, it is indeed an epithet described him, that's used to describe Alexander is undefeated, like Heracles, and even Caesar toys with the adjective as well. The epithet, he's undefeated, Alexander. So for the Greeks in the 1st, 2nd centuries AD, Alexander is a model for how great and how powerful Greco-Macedonian culture was.
I suppose history is not just written by the victors, it's written by your successors.
It's written by the successors, yeah. Alexander, yeah, that's a good example. History written by the victors. We have no contemporary literary historical sources for either Philip or Alexander the Great surviving, and not a single historical work survives from ancient Macedon. All literary history that survives about Philip and Alexander, and there was a lot written during their lifetimes by Greeks and by Macedonians, none of it survives. But what does survive is from much, much later Greek historians and Roman historians writing 300 years or later after Alexander's death, but of course drawing on those earlier lost examples. So yeah, I suppose in this instance, yes, it's history written by successors rather than written by the victors.
Wow, I didn't realize that there was nothing from his contemporary time period. That's amazing.
Oh, well, we have inscriptions, we have a lot of inscriptions, we have a lot of coins, we have archaeology, some even historical sources. And we have an awful lot of bits surviving in other historians, other literary works. But in terms of the people who wrote contemporary histories of Alexander during his lifetime and in the generation afterwards, so those who knew him, loads of people wrote works. We have dozens of names surviving, but only fragments survive of them. It's 300 years until we have the first historical account of Alexander's reign that survives, Diodorus Siculus, writing around 50 BC, nearly 300 years after Alexander's death. So there is this huge gap in our study of Alexander.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, just to, as we're about running out of time, to finish up, can you let us know what you're working on at the moment?
At the moment? Well, I'm in the process of finishing and very close to sending to the publisher a book on entitled Politics of Freedom, Kings and Cities in the Hellenistic World, which is a study of the rhetoric of Eleftheria, which is the Greek word for freedom. Study of the rhetoric of freedom, autonomy, and democracy in the Hellenistic world, but particularly through the prism of how these terms were used to negotiate power relations between the new Macedonian monarchies and the old Greek city-states. But I've also been working quite a lot recently on Alexander the Great, so I've written probably 4 or 5 articles or book chapters on him in the last 2-3 years or so. So a kind of profitable, rich stream of work for me in the last couple of years. And I have an idea for a project on Alexander as a model for ancient rulership in the Hellenistic and Roman world that I hope to move on to once I finish the Freedom book, once I'm free from Freedom.
Well, this is very, very interesting. I will be sure to include links to all relevant articles and hopefully books by that time. But I just want to say thank you so much for talking to me today. I found that absolutely fascinating to learn so much about Alexander and Philip and ancient Macedon and Hellenistic time periods and Alexander's nose being knocked off as a mummy. I did not know that one.
Yeah, it's more one of the more ignominious parts of his afterlife, I suppose. Noseless Alexander. But thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to speak with you, Anya.
Thank you.